And we are in 1 Samuel chapter 20. We missed last week with the weather. We canceled church because it was pretty nasty. And so we pick up 1 Samuel 20. Not sure what I said the first time. All right, in 1 Samuel 20, to summarize to the middle of the chapter, Jonathan and David, of course, are, that phrase doesn't make sense, but Jonathan loved David as he loved his own soul, and in the meanwhile, Jonathan's dad, Saul, the king, is trying to kill David because he's jealous and because he's envious and has an evil spirit from the Lord that he's having to deal with. And so Jonathan and David have made a covenant together that extends to each other's seed. In other words, here is David, the anointed king, whereas Jonathan would be, by proxy, the king without David in the picture because his father's king. And so you have here two possible kings to be that are instead best friends, and so they're having to work around each other. Usually when a king dies or is killed, then there's every expectation that all of his progeny could very well be killed, just because the next king doesn't want a lot of problems with the old king's kids and wives and stuff. And so these two guys are making this covenant, this promise between them, that they will honor their great friendship and before the Lord, and that neither of their seed is in danger from either of them killing that seed. So in verse 17, this is a place we stopped. David is still trying to avoid Saul, and they're trying to figure out how to deal with this. In verse 17, and Jonathan caused David to swear again because he loved him. Because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. These men were not merely friends. I mean, they were a lot more than Facebook friends, you know what I'm saying? The perverts have tried to make this a homosexual thing, which of course is not right. And so that's not true. These two men loved each other as they loved their own souls. So we go on to verse 18, which is where we begin tonight. Then Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon." Now, what they've talked about is we got to figure out if Saul is really trying to kill David or if this is just a temper tantrum he throws once in a while. And David's convinced that Saul's trying to kill him. Jonathan has had his father swear to him in a chapter before that, "No, I won't kill David, I promise." But Saul's vows are not very good, as has been proven. So they're trying to figure out if Saul is really trying to kill David. Verse 18. Then Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon." We discussed the new moons last time. In Jewish history, the new moons were a big deal, and we don't honor them anymore, nor should we. But they would have like a three-day festival at the beginning of each month where they got together and there were things they did. So it was like a monthly thing for 3 days. So tomorrow's the new moon, he says in verse 18. "And thou shalt be missed." It's already been determined that David is going to go back, is going to go hide in the field. And Jonathan is going to say that David asked to go home for 3 days for a feast of their own. And we'll see how Saul responds to this. Well, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and thou shalt be missed because thy seat shall be empty. And when thou hast stayed 3 days," he's going to go out into the field to find a nice place to camp for 3 days so that they can determine if Saul is really trying to kill him or not. "Thou shalt go down quickly and come to the place where thou didst hide thyself when the business was in hand." First of all, I'll go back to 19:2. Just a chapter earlier where Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David, and Jonathan told David, saying, "Saul, my father, seeketh to kill thee. Now therefore I pray thee, take heed to thyself till the morning, and abide in a secret place and hide thyself. And that was the incident where Jonathan took his dad outside. They had a man-to-man talk, and Jonathan was able to convince his dad that he shouldn't kill David. And so Saul swore to the Lord that he wouldn't kill David. But now nobody's convinced that's the case. So back to 1 Samuel 20, verse 19. That's what the secret place is about. When thou hast stayed 3 days, then thou shalt go down quickly and come to the place. In other words, the place you hid before, where thou didst hide thyself, when the business was in hand. Now, I've thought about that phrase for a while, and you know what I think it thinks? It means just exactly what we think it means. We say, oh man, that argument got way out of hand, right? I think that's exactly what this means. Back in chapter 19, it wasn't so wild or goofy as it is now, but now it's plainly gotten out of hand. So Jonathan uses that phrase, when the business was in hand, and so it's now out of hand, it's gotten worse, and shalt remain by the stone easel. Now, my Bible tries to help me out once in a while with a center margin reinterpretation of things, and according to it, now, this when the business was in hand should read, in the day of the business. So I'm sure that helps you a lot, because it really helped me. All the changes they make never make any sense. Anyway, just so you know. Back to verse 20. And here's what they're going to do. And you're hiding in the field. You're going to camp out 3 days while we have this three-day feast. And I'll come out and I will shoot three arrows on the side thereof as though I shot at a mark. And behold, I will send a lad, saying, go find out the arrows. Now, I'm not sure. I've struggled with this little scenario here before. And best I can come up with is, okay, he's going to take this kid out and he's going to try his arrows. He's going to shoot his arrows. David's hiding and he's going to shoot these arrows. And if he shoots the arrow near, he's going to tell the kid, oh, the arrow landed on this side of you, so that means David can come on, come on, come on in, it's okay. But if he says, no, the arrow went beyond you, go, like that, then David's supposed to take from that he should leave and run. And that's what happens. But, you know, I don't know why somebody takes a bow and arrow out and just shoots arrows near a rock. And the best I can figure is, I guess a warrior would probably want to test his bowstring to make sure it was still powerful enough that the rigidity or the flexibility of the bow was what it should be. I'm presuming that was that sort of thing, kind of like you'd go in and sight your deer rifle. I'm not sure what else it would be. Anyway, and behold, verse 21, I'll send a lad saying, go find out the arrows. If I expressly say to the lad, behold, the arrows are on this side of thee. No, come back this way. They landed on this side of you. Then you know, David, that you can come in. That are on this side of thee, take them. Then come thou, he's talking to David, for there is peace to thee and no hurt as the Lord liveth. But if I say thus to the young man, behold, the arrows are beyond thee. Go thy way, for the Lord hath sent thee away. So he's saying that again to David, go thy way, and under those circumstances, because the Lord sent you away. Verse 23, and as touching the matter which thou and I have spoken of, behold, the Lord be between thee and me forever. Now, that's just a covenant, a vow, an agreement between two men. In New Testament theology, that would be eternal security. Because we have Jesus Christ has made an agreement with us forever. Verse 24. So David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon was come, the king sat him down to eat meat. And the king sat upon his seat, as at other times, even upon a seat by the wall. King's got his back to the wall. That covers, that's a security measure. Maybe it's a matter of paranoia for him, but if you sit with your back to the wall, then at least nobody can kill you from behind. So you can basically see, you know, out in front if there's anything going on. So he's sitting by the wall, and Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side, and David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul spake not anything that day, for he thought, something hath befallen him. He's not clean. Surely he's not clean. Here's a guy trying to murder somebody else, and he wonders about how clean he really is. You know, oh, he's probably not here because he's probably sinned this week and can't come in here. You know, it's just ridiculous. But that's the way we are, right? Verse 26, nevertheless, Saul spake not anything that day, for he thought, something hath befallen him. He's not clean. Surely he's not clean. And it came to pass on the morrow, which was the second day of the month, that David's place was empty. And Saul said unto Jonathan, his son, wherefore cometh not the son of Jesse to meat, neither yesterday nor today? And Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. Now, he's lying. It's just an agreed story. And, you know, you may have to wrestle a little bit with whether the Lord blessed a lie here or not. In the end, you're not supposed to lie, right? But these guys felt that it was necessary to do so. And so whether or not the Lord blessed the lie, you'll have to make up your own mind. But there's some more that comes from it a little bit later. Go on back to verse 28. Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem, hometown. And he said, let me go, I pray thee, for our family hath a sacrifice in the city, and my brother, he hath commanded me to be there. And now if I have found favor in thine eyes, let me get away, I pray thee, and see my brethren. Therefore he cometh not to the king's table. The explanation to Saul. And Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. And he said unto him, thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman. It's your mother's fault. Thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman. Now, Saul's wife, Jonathan's mother, is Ahinoam of Ahimaaz. And I looked them both up, and there are other Ahinoams and another Ahimaaz. And you get nothing from those from the passages about anything about Saul's wife. So the bottom line, he's calling him a name. He's essentially cursing him by his mother. In English, there is a similar phrase. I'm just saying. But that's what it is. Thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion and unto the confusion of thy mother's nakedness? In other words, your mother bore you, conceived you, bore you, and had you, and you're dishonoring your mother, even though she's a perverse, rebellious woman. It's one of those goofy things where a guy's just mad calling names and it doesn't make any sense what he's saying. So, verse 30. Do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion? Now, in the Bible, the definition of confusion is tumult or disorder caused by blending things that shouldn't be together. So, in the Bible, a confusion, bestiality is called confusion in Leviticus 20. No, Leviticus 18. A man being with his daughter-in-law is called confusion in Leviticus 20. Here, it's confusion because you have a king who has a son who would be king, but here is David who's been anointed king, and they have to work all that out. So that's confusion. And David is confusing, he's saying, Jonathan, because Jonathan is rightfully, in Saul's mind, the next king. Confusion also, Job was confused over why righteous men suffer. The Ephesians were confused by their idols, according to Acts chapter 19. Let me show you another couple of places where things are confused. Just real quick, New Testament application. Look in 1 Corinthians 14. 1 Corinthians chapter 14. Verse 33. Now, this is the context of people speaking in unknown tongues. And for people to get up and babble like a bunch of chickens, where nobody knows what anybody's saying, if there's anything that is, it's confusion. I wish that you could go back in time to both of my grandmother's chicken houses, because that was a cacophony of confusion. It's 1,000 chickens at the same time going, bawk, 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 bawk. And so it's just you know, ear splitting for one and confusing in the other. And that's what Paul describes as going on in a church where there's tongues going on. And we're not talking about somebody speaking, you know, giving a testimony in Arabic and having someone testify. We're talking about people getting up and babbling senselessly, which is what modern charismatic Christianity does. Nobody's speaking in another language. Nobody's coming in speaking Nigerian and then having it, you know, translated. People are standing up babbling endlessly, and it's just nonsense. That was not the biblical way. It was never that way biblically. Now, Socrates admonished that it was that way in Socrates' day. There were people that would stand up because they were demonic and babble uncomprehendingly. And actually, in Socrates' day, among the philosophers and Aristotle's day, that went on. But that is not something that goes on in a Christian church. And it shouldn't. The other occasion I would have you note is James. James chapter 3. I know this is going off a little on the side, but James 3. James chapter 3. And this is the context of worldly wisdom versus godly wisdom. And worldly wisdom is confusing. All you have to do is look what's gone on in the news and in the science for the last 4 years. None of it meshes. None of it goes together. It's not consistent. It's different. However, somebody wants it to be different. That's what goes on. I'm sorry. Evolution is confusion. It's crazy. An explosion formed all this. It's the most orderly explosion I ever saw. It's crazy. I mean, it's literally nuts. But it's the world's wisdom. Now, it says this in verse 14. It's admonishing. James is admonishing these folks. Verse 14, but if you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom, the wisdom that leads to bitter envying and strife in your hearts, that is a church fighting and fussing, this wisdom descendeth not from above, but is earthly, sensual, devilish. Okay, that's worldly wisdom. It's the wisdom that would incite a riot. And then a news media that said that was fine until the wrong political party had a similar incident. And then it's a revolution. Right? It's confusion. Verse 16, for where envying and strife is, there is confusion, there's the word, and every evil work. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure. Did you ever notice how none of the worldly wisdom purists, philosophers, and propagandists are slightly interested in what's right? That is morally absolute right. Is it okay to teach kids that they're the wrong gender? It never crosses their mind whether it's right to do so. It just serves their purposes. Okay? So first of all, the wisdom that is from above is first pure. So if you're trying to make a decision, a wise decision, and what the Lord wants you to do or what the Lord would have for you, if the first thing about it is that there's something wrong about it, it ain't God. It's just not God. It's first pure, then peaceable. Now, folks say, well, I've got peace about it. Yeah, folks have gotten peace for shacking up. And people get peace for going out and getting high. I go, well, I have peace about it. I make the worst decision in the world and say, well, I had peace about it. Well, no, it's first pure, then peaceable. It's not just an argumentation. It's you legitimately have the peace from having done right. Verse 17, first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated. So it's easy to ask. I mean, the Lord says, you know, if you lack wisdom, if any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God, because the Lord wants you to give it to you. You're not going to get slapped for asking wisdom, for wisdom. Not with the Lord. Maybe with somebody else, but not the Lord. It's first pure, peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. So if you've made a decision and what came out of it is nothing but woe and trouble, there is a likelihood that it wasn't the best decision. Right? So, and that's confusion. The world's wisdom versus heavenly wisdom. So, science, where it opposes the Bible. Psychology, where it opposes what God said. Right? Tradition. Our family's always done it this way. Our religion's always done it this way. But it opposes the Bible. That's confusion. And where you went wrong was having worldly wisdom instead of seeking God's wisdom first. Okay, back to 1 Samuel. Like I said, strayed a little ways off there because Saul says, verse 30, middle of the verse, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion? Just one more lesson about this confusion thing. In the case of what we talked about as applying to us with wisdom and the whole charismatic flopdoodle thing, notice in this case, the confusion is a choice. Now, I know Saul sang it, so you have to take it with a grain of salt, but so often it's your choice that throws things into a kink. It just does. So, do not I know, now Saul's accusing Jonathan falsely, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion? That doesn't obfuscate the fact that most folks still choose the wrong thing in decision making, and it makes for confusion. Right? That part's still true. Verse 30, and unto the confusion of thy mother's nakedness. She bore you, she conceived you, bore you, and now you're dishonoring her by choosing Jonathan over me and her. And it's not the case. Verse 31, for as long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. That's what Saul's thinking. Saul wants Jonathan to be king. Lord doesn't call Jonathan to be king. He wants David as the king. And so Saul's mad about that. Verse 31, wherefore now send and fetch him unto me, for he shall surely die. Now, Saul's one to talk because Saul was, when losing a battle to the Philistines, he discovers that Jonathan inadvertently disobeyed an order not to eat anything, right? And he said, okay, Jonathan, for that, thou shalt surely die. Only the people wouldn't let him kill him. It's got to be ironic that Saul says this about David, and then it's just not that many chapters later. Look at 2 Samuel chapter 12. 2 Samuel chapter 12. Saul, a type of the Antichrist. David, a type of Jesus Christ. And yet, 2 Samuel chapter 12, after David has messed up with Bathsheba, conspired against Uriah the Hittite, in comes Nathan the prophet, tells David the story about this pet lamb and how a merciless, greedy neighbor took the guy's pet lamb and killed it. And what should we do about this? Well, verse 5, David doesn't know the stories about him. So in verse 5, David's anger was greatly kindled against the man, and he said unto Nathan, as the Lord liveth, the man that hath done this thing shall surely die. And so saying that, he would have signed his own death warrant. So here's Saul saying, oh yeah, he shall surely die. David said the same thing. Back to 1 Samuel 20, verse 32. And Jonathan answered Saul, his father, said unto him, wherefore shall he be slain? What hath he done? He hadn't done anything. He defeated a giant that Saul wouldn't fight. In fact, that no Israelite would fight. There's a lot of things David did, but none of them were bad, and none of them against Saul. Verse 33. And Saul cast a javelin at him, this is Jonathan, his own son, to smite him, whereby Jonathan knew that it was determined of his father to slay David. So Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger. So he's mad. He's ticked off. And did eat no bread or no meat the second day of the month. For he was grieved for David because his father had done him, I take that to mean David, shame. And Saul did want to treat him shamefully. He wanted to kill him for no reason. Verse 35. Came to pass in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David and a little lad with him. And he said unto his lad, run, find out now the arrows which I shoot. And as the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the lad was come to the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried after the lad and said, is not the arrow beyond thee? And so he's telling David, you need to go, you need to run. Verse 38, and Jonathan continues, and Jonathan cried after the lad, make speed, haste, stay not. And Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came to his master. But the lad knew not anything, only Jonathan and David knew the matter. And Jonathan gave his artillery, notice that a bow is artillery, gave his artillery unto his lad and sent him, and said unto him, rather, go carry them to the city. Now, this last couple of verses, it's just weird because they made this deal where, you know, if I do this, shoot it out beyond, shoot it closer, then you'll know to go. And that way we don't have to talk. So he does that, and then the lad goes back to town, and they still get together and hug and cry. I'm not sure what that's about other than I guess it was an excuse where if anybody asked the lad, no, Jonathan didn't meet with anybody. Because I'm not sure why they went through this elaborate ruse and then still met together, still in the middle of the field, and cried and hugged each other's necks. I'm not sure, other than that explanation. Verse 41. And as soon as the lad was gone, David arose out of the place, out of a place toward the south, fell on his face to the ground, and bowed himself three times, and they kissed one another and wept one with another until David exceeded. And Jonathan said to David, go in peace. For as much as we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord be between me and thee, and between my seed and thy seed forever. And he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. So they've left the covenant in place, so that lays the groundwork later, after David is king, and he's doing pretty good, that he goes and finds Mephibosheth to be merciful to, because that was Jonathan's son. 21, wow, I'm going to go a little bit longer here. I didn't realize it was that late. 21:1. Then came David to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. Now, if you remember, we went through this back in 1 Samuel 3, where eventually it's Zadok the priest that winds up the priest that's supposed to be in office. This is still Eli's seed. Ahimelech is from the line of Eli. And so God promised he was going to destroy Eli's seed because of Eli's wickedness. But verse 1, then came David to Nob to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid at the meeting of David and said unto him, why art thou alone and no man with thee? And you find out later he had some guys with him, but apparently nobody of stature that Ahimelech recognized. Verse 2, David said unto Ahimelech the priest, the king hath commanded me a business. Okay, now again you have David lying, okay, to cover for himself. And when you come through this passage, it depends on how you look at things. There are some things here that would lend you the idea that maybe David's out of the will of God and doing this runner thing. And whether or not that's true, I'm not sure. But in the meantime, it sets you up to realize that when you're in dire straits, you have a tendency to, you know, be self-preserving to the point of lying or acting like a madman later in the passage. And so that's not the best state to be in. Preferably, you do right regardless. Right? Verse 2, and David said unto Ahimelech the priest, the king hath commanded me a business. He hadn't. And hath said unto me, let no man know anything of the business whereabout I send thee and what I have commanded thee. That didn't happen. That wasn't the case. And I have appointed my servants to such and such a place. Now therefore, what is under thine hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in mine hand and what there is present. And the priest answered David and said, there is no common bread under mine hand, but there is hallowed bread. Now, he's talking there about the showbread in the tabernacle, okay? In the tabernacle, they set up 12 loaves, one for each a tribe. And then at the end of the day, they trade the bread out for fresh bread. And then the priests can eat the showbread that's been pulled off the table. But common people don't do that. And so all he's just saying, all we have here is hallowed bread, not common bread. Verse 4, and the priest answered David, said, there is no common bread under mine hand, but there is hallowed bread, if the young men have kept themselves at least from women. Now, the only thing I can come up with on this, because there's no definitive, nothing I found anyway that was definitive, but there were no women in the priesthood in the Old Testament. Just like there's not supposed to be any women in the pastorate in the New Testament. And so the priests that minister in the tabernacle, you know, it's all men. And so he's saying, have you been kept from women? And it says in verse 5, and David answered the priest and said unto him, of a truth, women have been kept from us. So that shows David's not truly alone. He has some young men with him, but apparently not anyone of any stature within, you know, Saul's administration. And so Ahimelech's confused. But of a truth, women have been kept from us about these 3 days. So both Old Testament, and I'm sorry, it's true of the New Testament too, a woman has no business in the pastorate. And has no business usurping authoritative teaching over men. That's why ladies don't teach the adult Sunday school class. And that's why the ladies don't teach teenage men back there. It's because it's not right. So how do you know? Because the Bible says so. It's for that reason. So you say, well, what about the Southern Baptists? They do it all the time. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, it's in the newfangled goofball churches with goofball names. It's not just pastor Kyle Stevens, it's Pastor Kyle and Marcy Stevens. And we don't do that either. She's my helpmeet, not your pastor. Ladies, she's in this because God called me, not because God called her. She's in it because he called me, and she's my helpmeet for me. So she plays liaison in the nursery, which is a good thing. Because, well, you know how nursery, you know how good I would be in the nursery. So I appreciate that. She's my liaison with the ladies, okay, which is good because there needs to be something between me and ladies because I usually just offend them and they leave before the opening remarks of the sermon are done. So, but just to make straight. Anyway, verse 5. David answered the priest and said unto him, of a truth, women have been kept from us about these 3 days since I came out, and the vessels of the young men are holy. So maybe that's talking about the body. And the bread is in a manner common, yea, though it were sanctified this day in the vessel. Now, I found a passage back in Leviticus where it talks about putting that showbread off the table into a vessel, and then the vessel's taken out, and then the priests eat of it, okay? So maybe that's talking about a literal vessel that you carry bread in. Verse 6, so the priest gave him hallowed bread, and there was no bread there but the showbread. And even Jesus Christ in Matthew 12 says that the priest, that David got to eat the showbread. So that's what that is. That was taken from before the Lord. Verse 6. To put hot bread in the day when it was taken away. So you take the cold showbread and put hot showbread in its place. And then the priests go eat the cold. Verse 7. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. I'm not sure what that's about, detained before the Lord. And his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chiefest of the herdmen that belonged to Saul. And David said unto Ahimelech, and is there not here under thine hand spear or sword? For I have neither brought my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. He's still lying. And the priest said, the sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom thou slewest in the valley of Elah, behold, it is here wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If thou wilt take that, take it, for there is no other save that here. And David said, there is none like that. Give it to me. So we now close. We'll close this here. Went a little longer than I wanted. Any questions or comments so far? Kind of a